Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is not a diving podcast, but scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving Podcast. Okay, it's Tuesday the 14th of November. A little bit late getting this out. It's Tuesday evening, CET, which is where I am. But we are here, absolutely. We did a little bonus pod yesterday to give you a little taster of what it's like to be a podcast supporter. Because, of course, we are currently in the midst of a 2023 Not a Diving Podcast pledge drive. Thanks to all of you who have signed up so far. We are nowhere near the target that we had. We're a week in though, so we're only halfway through. I've got to say that UK listeners, you make up 80%, at least 80% of the actual audience for this show, but less than 5% of the supporters. You are letting yourselves down there. So if you're a UK listener, it's time, I think, if you're a regular listener, if you're tuning in every week, maybe it's something you should think about. Because, yeah, the Brits are apparently pretty tight. I never really dug into those figures before, but yeah, it's pretty shocking. And actually, it kind of tallies with the Bandcamp figures for supporters, extra supporters, the people who give extra money when they buy stuff on Bandcamp that we talked about on the show a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. Wow. Brits are tight. Who would have thought? But it's never too late to change your ways, British people. So yeah, scubaofficial.io/support. Remember, you get the Musicality t-shirt if you sign up on Patreon, the Musicality tier, which is a great t-shirt, I have to say. I'm going to post a few pics of it actually tomorrow. And also, you know, just the knowledge in addition to the other stuff you get as part of the Patreon tiers, the knowledge that you're supporting one of the best, if not the best, music podcast out there, right? That's what I think. And you know you agree with me. Oh dear. It's Tuesday night and I've had a glass of wine, but that's fine because the guts of today's show was recorded last week and it's with Adrian Sherwood. Great to have an absolute legend, an unambiguous legend on the show. He's a legend of UK dub. I think it's a legend of dub music generally. But he's also worked with people like Ministry, Nine Inch Nails, and Blur, amongst lots of others. So the very last question actually in the conversation today is informed by one of those people, and it comes slightly out of the blue if you're not aware of his work with said artist. It was a little bit truncated, the conversation. He had to run off at the end, and it wasn't quite as long as I wanted it to be, but it's really great nonetheless, and I think you're going to enjoy it. So yeah, Adrian Sherwood. Right, before we get started on that, a reminder about the pledge drive. scubaofficial.io/support. If you can't do that, if you genuinely can't afford it, then yeah, okay, I accept that. Follow the show wherever you listen to this podcast. Hit the follow button, hit the review button, hit the 5-star review button, and leave a review, a gushing review. That would be nice. And it would also help the show. You could also follow the Spotify playlist. There's a link in the show notes to that playlist. And join us on the Discord if you want to complain about me doing too much of a hard sell with regards to direct donations, direct support for the show. You can leave a direct donation as well, by the way, not just Patreon. But if you want to complain about that, then hotflushrecordings.com/discord is the place to do it. We'd love to see you there regardless of what you have to say, almost regardless of what you have to say. So yeah, okay, without further delay, here is Adrian Sherwood. Adrian Sherwood, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you, Scuba. Very nice to be here.
Nice one. Please call me Paul, by the way.
Paul.
I'm just like, yeah, that's much better.
Should we start again? Do you want to start again?
No. No, that's fine. It's fine. Just for, I'm just eternally embarrassed by that DJ name, to be honest, that I've been lumbered with for 20 years. One of those ones. Anyway, yeah, great to be finally doing this. I wanted to kick off by asking you, well, I had a conversation on the show last week, which is not typical actually, but we talked a lot about new developments in music tech and how it's changed in the last couple of decades. And I wanted to ask you how you make music now, today, because obviously you've been, you've seen the whole kind of arc, right, since the 70s or so of the methods of making music. So how do you do it these days?
Well, if there's the great things from the past that you have to, well, if you don't have to, but if you know them, that's great. And you've got things happening at the moment that are just mind-blowing. So I try to... I can't operate all the computers. I've got to be honest, I'm not... I'm an old analog person, so I have to do analog mixing, which is what I love. But we do a lot of things in the box, what they call in the box, in the computer, which is what every, you know, 95% of producers do, I think, in their bedrooms or in their studio setups anyway. But what I would tend to do is, if I've got a band to record, I would want to go into a really good old school studio to record it properly, you know, using all the good mics, everything, and make sure I'm in a good room. And after that, we go like probably everybody else and work inside the computer, nudging things, treating things, then overdubbing at our place with using good, you know, good amps, vintage EQs, vintage spring reverbs, vintage stuff, and then carry on that way. And then in the final thing, I'll be using whatever really excites me at the moment in the final mix. So I'm not all analog, you know, with tape, because it's just too expensive to work on, but... The days of tape are a happy memory for me, a fond memory, and also a very creative one. You know, using tape creatively was great, but now, you know, with what you can do now, it's mind blowing. There's some brilliant things happening.
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot of the focus of music tech development in the last 10, 15 years has been trying to recreate those classic analog sounds. Like there's the emulation of consoles and of stuff like the classic effects, like spring reverb and all that kind of stuff. How do you feel about that stuff? And have you, I mean, is it a decent alternative to using the real thing?
Yeah, definitely is. Definitely. I've got so many brilliant plugins that we don't even, you know, haven't even got around to checking. But there's so many that are stunning. You know, the new Lexicon plugin, they sound like the vintage stuff. There's countless wonderful things, but you know, to me, nothing replaces like the still proper physical outboard, because you actually touch it and interact with it and bash it while you're working. I'm trying to answer the question. Yeah, the replacements are stunning, but it's like any tool. If you're working with a vintage drum machine or a vintage synth and you use it well, it's the same thing with what is your weapon, your sonic weaponry, so to speak, that you use to attack your mix with, you know, make it pulse and breathe.
Mm. Yeah. So one of the things that came out of my conversation last week was about workflow and how important it is to be comfortable in what you're doing, and you know how useful it can be to use plugins versus outboard stuff, but also in reverse too. So, I mean, I've certainly had phases in this year where I felt much more comfortable, like you say, having my hands on something. But then sometimes I've found that it doesn't necessarily work with how my kind of music making brain works. By the sound of things, you're very much a kind of hands-on knobs kind of a guy.
Yeah, but well, I've got a wonderful engineer. I work with Matt Smith, who's been my engineer for the last few years, who's absolutely brilliant. And you end up like bouncing off each other. You know, it's really good. So we've got a set of go-to plugins and effects that we use throughout the, you know, when we're making rhythms, building tracks, as I've acquired the words for the Jamaican thing. It's build a rhythm, let's make a track. Right. And it is like that. You're almost like building a house, aren't you? And then deconstructing it and then adding a new roof to it or a cellar. It's like we will go to certain things that I like. I'm at that one that does this, that one that does that. You know, you'll know exactly what I mean. And then we'll go to... I think continuity in the production's really good. So I've got some vintage things that I love and always use. And then we've also got some plugins that we love, you know, from the recent ones that we just know that we've come across recently. And we tend to go through periods of using a set of sounds, and it does give the productions a continuity as well, rather than just randomly using any old thing. And then what I love to do is I like to plug one into another. So take a reverb, plug it into a phaser, then plug it into a parametric, and then get movement in the sound to make it breathe. And that might be a combination of the plug-in with the desk, putting up a channel on the desk and putting it through a Cinema Engineering EQ or a Langevin or something, or even just a desk EQ sweeping it, and then plugging the output of that into... you know, a tape delay or a digital delay. I'm just using two or three things and plugging them into each other.
Is this kind of process how you made the Creation Rebel album that just came out?
Well, the Creation Rebel album was we decided to embark on it during lockdown, as we did quite a few other things. And lockdown proved such a brilliant period for a lot of artists, because you suddenly had this almost tranquil vibe around. Everything was like still almost. So right, let's embark on this. Then it was a matter of getting into a studio in London. The lads went into a studio in Harlesden and laid down a few rhythms. I had already had a few things here that I'd been working on. I got Charlie to overdub the drums. So it was a matter of getting good decent microphones in London. It wasn't like the most expensive studio, but Stingray Studio, a good studio. Then down at mine, we've got some great mics and things here, doing the same thing. And back and forth, doing all the processes I just described. So that album, you know, it's... and then we obviously augmented it. We had Gaudi. Gaudi added a bit of sparkle with some melody bits on two or three tunes, and some other great guest players as well. And it's not overproduced, except for maybe my track, Push Me, Pull You. No, that's more like it, rather. I'm confusing it with Head Charge. That's more like it track. You know, that's probably one of the more produced dub tunes. But it's, it's a solid piece of work. It's reflecting where everybody's at, really, that album.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was listening to it this morning, and yeah, it sounds great. So, I mean, is it difficult to find good studio space these days? Because obviously that's one of the things that's happened in the last 20 years, is there's been a real decline of quote-unquote proper studios.
Well, you're going to have to save up. If you're a band, you know, you don't go into some second-rate place and do it in a rehearsal room or anything. Your best investment is just go to one of the big studios and say, look, we're a little band. We'd really dream of playing in here. When you've got a dead day or something, could we perhaps come in here with one of your assistants and get the studio at half price or something? We'll pay you cash, you know. Or all the studios are approachable, because they do get a cancellation or they've got a dead day. Go approach, you know, one of the best studios, speak to the studio manager, you know, be polite to he or her, and try and get the best studio, because that investment, when you get back to your studio or your front room or wherever you're working, you've suddenly got something that's sparkling and sounds, it sounds expensive. It sounds like real, you know. The Creation Rebel album we recorded in actually, you know, a cheap, you know, relatively reasonably priced studio, but one that was, You know, if anyone wants to record reggae, somewhere like Stingray. Or if you want one of, you know, the best studios, you know, Mike Palenconi, Prince Fatty, he's opened a new studio in South London. There are new ones opening. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to work with, you know, Mike, probably the best engineer for recording drums that there is, you're going to get a great result. So investing in something like going to, you know, Fatty's studio or you know, Matt Professor's got a studio and whatever, you just, it saves you money in the long run that you've recorded your thing properly. And then all the overdubbing, all the work with EQs, the work with plugins or whatever you're doing next, you're working, you're not struggling and fighting to make it sound good.
How much of a negative effect, if at all, has the decline of studios had on music that gets released generally, do you think?
It's two ways, really. I mean, it's a law of economics, supply and demand. People couldn't afford to maintain those studios. A lot of people I know, like Nigel Frieda, who owned the Matrix group of studios, you know, he was lucky to have a brother like John Frieda, who was very successful. And between them, they'd bought the freeholds. They loved the studio. He loved the studio business. He's a really good man, actually, Nigel. But they've ended up that the real estate value of the studio was so great. You know, one of the studios, I think the Holborn one, which they didn't actually own the building, is like a blooming yoga studio now. And, you know, and the others are probably multi-million pound flats. So studios have become less and less an attractive thing for either the owner of the studio or the owner of the building. And but there are a lot of studios, but most folk now, they I reckon, like I said, 95% of people probably don't even need a studio anymore. They're making everything digitally, and it also, that's why a lot of it sounds very samey. But there are studios all over, but I don't think in the old days you'd think of doing the whole record in a studio from the moment you mic'd up that bass drum till the minute you walked out shaking hands with the engineer and the crew who've worked and helped you or strangling them, whatever you might be doing. But, you know, the old days, it'd be the beginning to the end you'd spend in this, you know, lovely space or whatever. Now it's a case of get in, get the actual live performance recorded with, you know, with the players, and then do all the tracking and things elsewhere. It's not needed anymore. And that's because of the technology. It's not... in the old days, the technology wouldn't allow you to work in you know, in a kind of six-foot square room with no windows, which a lot of folk do now and make great records, you know, from their house. It's... you know, those beautiful studios, I miss the Manor. The Manor in Oxford was my favourite studio. It was residential. We used to stay there. We had... It was very creative because you had all of us together for days on end and knocking out, you know, an album a day kind of thing. You know, it was those days. I've got those happy memories. But now, unless you're like a kind of, you know, successful gigging band, to indulge yourself doing that, you know, all the young bands have to use the tactics I've described, really.
Has something been lost musically, do you think, by the decline of that sort of thing?
Well, I think the advent of the internet and all the great advancements, you know, allowing people to produce at home, that's the only thing I've been, I don't, you know, the studio things, studios are still there. There's loads of them around, loads, but... you know, they're expensive, but you don't, like I said, you don't need them for anything like however many. If you're spending 28 days making an album, you don't need the studio for more than maybe 2 or 3 days.
Sure, but when you're talking about, you know, going in and hanging out and, like, you know, there's a kind of creative back and forth in that process, which I think you don't... Well, I think that side of things is... Well, it's more difficult to come across, I think, now. Like with
You shouldn't, you know, to be writing in a studio, a whole record in a studio, if you can do it in your house or in a rehearsal room, you know, or you can do...
There's other ways.
I mean, if you've got good ideas, you've got good ideas. It's like thinking you're sat there and something's going to, you know... No, I think the real thing that gets me is like, now, in the old days, those ideas could be slowly nurtured and developed and... could come along, you know, from absolutely nowhere, from, you know, from Iceland with Bjork and Kirkle and all those people, and that nobody would have known except those who knew, and it was word of mouth. And now it's microscoped in a split second. Somebody will film a gig on their phone, or somebody will share something, and before you know it, other producers are microscoping an embryonic idea, and it just becomes very easily, what words do you, sanitized, or very easily somebody else gets into that. And then when there's a successful formula, people jump onto that formula of, you know, be it with Rhythms in Jamaica or other ideas, you know, and you get lots of, you know, dare I say it, it's like with B League, Ed Sheeran's or something. Sorry, but you know, whatever it might be. I don't really think that the internet has helped the things develop very gently anymore. It's all a lot more calculated or more microscoped. That's the problem.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that actually leads on to what was going to be my next question anyway, which was, I mean, stepping back and kind of zooming back to the very start of your career, like how was dub first imported to the UK? Like how did dub become well known in the UK in the first place?
Well, while people use the word dub, it was version. I mean, version's a much right. more key word to me. So you'd have a song that you loved, and then you'd hear, you know, a DJ or a second DJ or a second singer or an instrumental version of that rhythm. And then if you look back to, you know, the late 68 time, you know, albums coming like Lee Perry, the Kung Fu record and all those things, we're hearing loads of echoes and it's stripped down to just drum and bass and funny noises on it, and then reverbs and more eccentric versions. And then eventually the, you know, the first few dub records, people, you know, who were running the record labels. I was involved in running record labels from when I was 17 in 75. And you could see there was a little market, you know, it wasn't big, but a little market for, what, you know, Smokey Bears, people who liked a bit of weed, would, you could see they're, you know, they're really liking albums like I Tell Dub or King Tubby Meets the Upsetter at the Grassroots of Dub, or Lee Perry's Blackboard Jungle and, you know, the Lee Perry Kung Fu record, on and on. And a lot of people didn't want to, particularly because it had gone from, you know, the really fun records that, again, Lee was a big part of, the Rude records, the Mischievous records, that, you know, it was very, and all the skinheads were loving this stuff. And it suddenly, with the Black Pride thing from America, the Panthers, the Garveyist movement, they started getting more and more, it got blacker and blacker, and it got too black for a lot of the reggae fans. You know, the Madness fans, for example, bemoaned this period because they bemoaned the loss of the fun reggae from that they've been so fond of, and
it became too political. Is that
where it became too black?
Okay,
and the politics, they weren't really interested in politics, whatever type of politics, but a lot of it was like, you know, self-improvement for black folk, and the rise of, you know, the Rasta movement. They couldn't really relate to it. So the dub, while it didn't satisfy any more than the Root stuff did, those type of fans, it created a whole new movement where a lot of students, a lot of, you know, dub heads emerged that were really into the stuff because it wasn't challenging you with loads of lyrics.
Right. Oh, wow. That's really interesting. Okay. I never thought about it like that. But yeah, that actually makes sense. For people who aren't aware of the kind of, I don't know how to describe this, I was going to say racial politics, but I'm not quite sure that's quite right. Just the kind of cultural crossover, which meant that skinheads were into reggae. Like, can you just...
But you know, you've got to bear in mind skinheads...
It's not the kind of skinheads we necessarily associate with neo-Nazis.
No,
yeah,
no, not,
yeah,
no,
that's my question. Yeah, so can you just describe that?
Well, you know, society in England, I mean, I could, you know, going back on the social history of England and the oppression of the people in this country is shocking. You know, they were used as like cannon fodder in one war after another. They were never treated. In England, you've got to bet it's a class war here. It's not. It still is to this day. You know, a lot of these Tories will pretend it's not a class war, but it is an out-and-out class war. Who controlled the land? You know, look at leases on properties and who really owns the land and, you know, what people were, you know, people come back from the war and, you know, one war after another and they'd be still living some crap life on a farm in Scotland or something that was owned by some British English landlord or something.
Owned by the royal family.
And yeah, and the royal family. They had no choice what to do. And then you roll it forward, you know, the late 40s, a lot of black people start coming in. And this always blaming somebody else. If we've got it now with blaming people coming over on a ship to where I live here in Ramsgate, arriving on the beach, you know, like, go back to where you came from kind of attitude. Well, each of those people brought something to this country, which is a country of immigrants. There's no indigenous English person or whatever, no such thing. And everyone came here. And when the black folk came, they and the Asian people, they faced, you know, horrible racism. But they mixed with a lot of kids on, you know, council estates in poor areas from Bristol to Cardiff, particularly early on, Liverpool. And they mixed. And bit by bit, a lot of the kids, the skinheads, came from, like, just, look, this is me stripped to the bone, raw, you know, raw. It was a raw feeling that had, you know, it had many facets to it. There's a good movie that a friend of ours made, World of Skinhead, which is very interesting. And it shows it, you know, and a lot of the skins were very, very close with the black kids. And there were black skinheads. And then there was another lot of them who were just horrible, scummy racists. So, but you know, the worst racist wasn't the skinheads, it was the teddy boys. The teddy boys were vehemently racist and horrible. That was my memory.
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the kind of image of skinheads it means something different now.
It's almost been taken over by more like the horrible Eastern European ones who went that way, you know. But there were elements of fans of bands like Madness that were, unfortunately, and I know that the band hated it, you know, that were very right-wing and Rollins, you know, so there were lots of contradictions, but the skinhead reggae scene was brilliant. I love those records, the fun, the energy, the still big fans of the ska tunes, and that was a golden period for reggae because it produced lots and lots of top 10 hits for the artists. And then we went into the period that out of which came, you know, Bob Marley and lots of other great roots artists that, you know, me and my mates loved. But the dub scene, That obviously ska and the two-tone thing filled a gap for the fans of the stuff from the 60s, the happy kind of more party-flavoured reggae. Then the two-tone, you know, the fans of the other stuff started going to their own version of it. And those of us who like the root stuff as well, you know, we were getting into some amazing stuff coming from Jamaica. And England as well. And then obviously this whole new market for dub, which was never really big, but it was, like I said, you know, a lot of Smokey Bears. You sit at home putting on a couple of instrumental records that were really trippy. It was, I always liked it.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, right. So did you grow up in London?
No, High Wycombe. I was born in London and I moved to firstly Slough when I was 2, and then when I was 9, my dad had died very early, and I'd moved to my mum my stepfather moved. We all moved to High Wycombe, so my formative years were there.
And how did you end up working at a label when you were 17?
In High Wycombe, there was a man who was like, it was like a dad to me, Joe Farquharson. Joe had been involved with Palmer Records in the 60s and right back to the 60s, Club 67, working with Max Romeo, promoting Wet Dream and loads of other stuff. Palmer, Joe had a club in High Wycombe called the Newlands Club, and I started DJing there on my friend Steve and myself on firstly Saturday afternoons, then Saturday and Sunday afternoons, and then early evenings opening up for people like Emperor Roscoe. I did shows with Judge Dredd, Johnny Walker, Dave Lee Travis, like really weird Radio 1 road shows in the afternoons. And I was like 14. And then when I was 15, I got a little job for Palmer. I went up on the train in my summer holidays. I used to go up there and collect promo records for my DJing as a kid. And then the Newlands, we had a really hot summer and it killed the Newlands Club. I mean, it literally went from being primarily a soul club. It wasn't reggae so much, you know, 15% reggae, the bulk of it soul. And suddenly it was like all the soul fans didn't come. And then the reggae fans, unfortunately, didn't drink enough to support the club. they'd have a spliff and two beers, and that was it for the night. So it wasn't a great business for Joe. The club went out and he started working for Palmer again. And then he brought me in and we started one of the first ever kind of independent distributors out of the building that eventually became Jetstar. And the same year as we started that, I got my driving license a month after my 17th birthday. And I was driving the length and breadth of Britain, selling labels, records. And then we started our own label. And then one thing after another, that's a whole story of my life.
Yeah. And no, I've got a few more questions about this whole period. But had you done any music prior to what you were just describing about DJing when you were a kid? Like, had you like learned instruments or anything like that? What was your...
No, I wasn't very... My tuning wasn't great. I was a bit kind of... I wasn't really... But my mum had been a good singer. My mum, weirdly, was going to join the George Mitchell Singers, which is really weird, which is like the... Was one of the things they did was the Black and White Minstrel Show.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. I know, really, really mental. But my mum was a really good singer, and... my stepfather, although we weren't close, he had music playing at the house from, a really wide variety of stuff he liked. But he didn't like reggae, which probably made me like it even more.
And,
so there was a musical thing there, and we always had music at the house, and, you know, I didn't do it. No, I had no particular leanings to actually... making music. Literally by fault did I become a producer.
Yeah, I've read your the interview you did with JD Twitch a while back. I was reading that this morning, and you talk about how the Creation Rebel project first started, and yeah, by the sound of things, like pretty accidental, right?
We started the distribution company after the fall of the Newlands Club, and I was at college. I wasn't happy, and I left after a year, so I was ready to do something. Joe's like, come on, you know, he knew he could trust me. And he was like my dad, to be honest. He took me under his wings. And if it weren't for him, you know, I can thank him eternally, you know. And, you know, his wife and his sons are like family to me now, like my brothers. So I have to thank Joe for getting me involved. But we were distributing records, then we started label licensing tapes. And I kept meeting musicians and producers and gunmen and people. I didn't know, I thought the gunmen were the producers. I was really naive and innocent, but I was working with a fella called Chips Richards, who had been involved in the music. I'd actually done a summer working for him at Vulcan, driving the van, Grenation Records, with Junior Lincoln and some other people, Webster Schrouder and some people who'd, you know, big players from Trojan days. And, you know, he'd started, Junior Lincoln had started the Reggae Sunsplash, you know, the thing. Interesting, strong people. And I'd had them all, took me under their wing a bit. So I was kind of nurtured into it. And then musicians started coming up and you become friendly with people because they're so lovely. And I thought, I had a bit of money and I thought, I'll run a session. And Chips made a phone call to Dennis Bavell for me and said, look, Adrian's wants to run a session. Can you engineer it for him? And that's how my friendship with Dennis started and my first venture into, you know, making a record. I literally winged it. I hummed the bass lines to the bass player I wanted to do, and made my own little designer dub album. It wasn't a band or anything, and eventually, excuse me.
Let me just ask you: was that a common thing that people did back then? That kind of approach to making a record.
Well, anybody could run a session if they had the money. You know, production meant if you're producer, meant you paid for it and you owned the tapes.
Yeah.
So a lot of people did it. I don't know who did it. I'm guessing a lot of people like Bunny Lee in Jamaica, when he started, he just financed everything. Therefore, he was the producer. And he was using whoever to engineer it for him because he wasn't an engineer. You know, that was how people started. I'm not comparing myself to Bunny Lee for a minute, but in England, I don't think there were... it wasn't unusual for people to run a session or for someone who owned, you know, a hairdressing business to finance a recording or someone else to. But I just kind of went into it. And my first one, the first record, did okay. John Peel really championed it. And saying it was the best dub record ever made in England. I'm thinking, Jesus, that's our record. And this is easy. I'm just doing what I like, you know. And... you know, it's never, you know, it wasn't not the biggest selling record on earth, but it got me started. And then I started meeting all these wonderful people, like, you know, the Mark Stewarts and non-reggae people. And I just kept recording. Whenever I had the money, I'd run a session. Then I got to a point where I'd run up bills of about 10 grand with a couple of studios. Bob Zimbler at Berry Street and another place. And I was literally making records, taking really bad advances off the likes of blooming Cherry Red Records, who were giving me less money than it cost me to make the things. But just to keep things ticking over, thinking, oh, I'll crack it, you know. And by then I had the bug and I was just...
Yeah, I mean, let me ask you a question about that. Like, did you have a clear idea during that period about what success meant, or were you just making tunes?
Oh, success meant paying off my debts. I had a 3.5 grand overdraft secured against my mum's house.
Right, okay. And yeah, that'll concentrate the mind, right?
And I think at the time the house was worth about 15 grand. That's how much that was. So it certainly focused the mind. I was just right. I've got to whatever I do to get clear these debts and keep going, because I actually love doing it, but yeah. At the same time, I didn't want to, you know, cause havoc for my ma, you know.
So this is like early 80s period. Is that where we are roughly? Or is it earlier?
No, this is still, well, yeah, well, by now, early, yeah, well, you could say, yeah, by now, early 80s, yeah.
Yeah. So the On You Sound label, which is still going, which is what you released the recent record on, that started in 79, right?
No, that started right at the end of 80 into 81. Okay. I think the first 7-inch was at the end of 80, I think. Or maybe it was, yeah, and then the beginning of 81 we started putting out New Age Steppers album, the first albums.
And what was the motivation there? Were you just like really deep in the music and just wanted to be involved, and running a label was just something you did, people did then?
Well, I'd always been told a very good trick by Chips. He said to me, look, if you wanted to try and do business, you've got to get a catalogue. Because if you're going to go now, and I'd been an early distributor before, you know, Palmer, Jetstar, took the idea off Joe and me and put it in the same building that created Jetstar. We had... Down the road, there was Mojo, who was Rodigan's friend, and a nice guy, Mo Claridge. And then there was Kasner. He had, what was Kasner's company called? I'd come back to him in a minute. Another distribution company, you know. And he said, look, if anyone wants to deal with you, or EMI, or any of these people, if you want to go for their distribution, which was national distribution at the time, which they didn't really want to touch any of the, you know, ghetto reggae people, they want a catalogue. They don't want to take one tune off you. They might license the tune and then contract you for an album or something if you're an artist. But they were interested in catalogue. So I tried with Hit Run to get the catalogue going as quick as I could in the 2 years it lived. We did about 10 albums and about 20, I don't even know how many, I can't even remember, 8 albums or something, 7, 6, 8 albums. My memory is a bit shot and then loads of 12 inches. I was trying to get a catalogue together. Then when I started On You, it was like, right, how do I get to having three or four titles so that Rough Trade or anybody would want to deal with me? That's what I was thinking about. And then he was saying, oh, you're the punky reggae part, you did all this. He says, no, I was just literally meeting people I really liked. And then there were big influences on me, like Mark Stewart. And at the same time, trying to get a few titles so I could do business with the distributors. Sounds really tacky, but that's honestly what I was thinking.
No, honestly, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's even now, it's pretty good advice, really, if you want to have longevity.
Well, no one's going to take you seriously. If you go now, I get people say, oh, I wanted someone to release my album. And everyone's got an album, you know. Don't know how many new albums does the world need? If you're looking physical, it's hard to sell. Unless, you know, we're lucky we've got 5,000 fans that will buy our stuff to build on, you know, or something like that. Thank God. So I can still do physical because I love holding it. You know, this looking at the sleeve and looking at the work, and there's the manifestation of the work. But if you want to try and go into any of the existing distributors, they're going to say, oh, look, man, sorry. Or, oh, we think it's really good. Give us 100. You know, it's that bad, literally, for something trying to embark on it. You somehow got to figure a way of getting people to even notice you before you can start going. And which gives you the platform of the internet, which is the route a lot of people go. They didn't even care about putting a physical thing out. Because there's more money swilling around the music business than ever, but the record business, which is, you know, thing, it's a very tough world to operate in because you have to have a fan base to be able to manufacture and sell that record. And in my case, a catalogue that you can keep dipping in and out of it and repressing to you know, when something gets enough demand on quantities to sell it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah, absolutely. So in that case, yeah, can you just, well, one of the things I pulled out of that JD Twitz interview, actually, when you're talking about the kind of economics of doing stuff in that kind of late 70s, early 80s period. And, you know, you talked about, you know, people are earning 50 quid a week, but it's 300 quid a day in a studio. You might sell a couple of thousand records if you're lucky, but you can sell out a couple of nights at Dingwalls. That's a specific example that you used in that interview. I mean, people talk about how difficult it is to make a living now for music, but I mean, that doesn't sound like an easy option back then either, right?
Well, luckily I worked with Prince Farai, who had a following, you know, and other legendary artists, you know, Bim, Prince Hammer, we did a tour. So working with Prince Farai gave me any credibility to get going and launch us into the live concert thing. I owe him everything on that, you know, because he got us the attention and propelled us forward. And he gave me productions of his to release. And then I worked on productions and overdubbed them with him and things, and that got me going. So we had a little fan base that we could start doing gigs. But it was still the same thing now. There were a lot of people in the game then, lots. But then it was like a record business, really was. But there's so many people vying for the shopkeeper to buy their wares or to stock their wares. It's pretty similar now, because you just got probably load more bods now trying to get noticed. It's just trying to get noticed. Stick your head above the the thing, you know, and get attention.
Right, yeah, I guess so. The difference is that, you know, in the days of record shops, there's literally a finite amount of shelf space, right? So you need to be on that shelf space. Whereas now it's like, it's a slightly different thing, which is, you know, getting noticed is just that much more, but it's ultimately the same problem of getting yourself in front of people.
Yes, yeah, completely. But, well, in those days, you know, it was a little store like Baba or Tim at Sound 7 in Dalston, they could take 500 copies of one 7-inch and sell it over a weekend. They wouldn't really want to have their shelves full of like one that when they played it, they might sell one copy of or two. They'd play it and it'd be 10 people sticking their hands up wanting to buy it. You know, that was how it was. Nowadays, the business, well, you know, in the old days, if you had a record played on Radio 1, you might have got 60 quid or something, and you might have had 8 million people listening to that record, and it got played a few times a day and all over the networks. Lesser and lesser monies for the smaller the station. You could maybe make, you know, a couple of grand a day for a massive hit record, or a grand or something a day. I don't know the figures, I'm just plucking it out of the air. But now with streaming, there's more money than ever, because forget the radio. If there's a big act that has got 200 million, 300 million streams, which is that's not even big figures compared to a lot of them. It is for me, that'd be a dream come true. But you've got acts now where, you know, every day there are like maybe 5 million people listening to one tune by one act.
Yeah.
Well, if you work out that each million streams is worth about $3,000 or whatever it is, or quid or whatever, you know, that could be, you know, 15 grand a day plus being earned by the act. When the old days, being played on Radio 1 and all over the world as a mega hit wouldn't make you anything like that. And that's just, you know, and then other acts are getting, you know, work with the artist Halsey, you know, 6 billion streams on one tune.
Yeah.
That's worth 18 million. You know, these are the figures that are there. If you can get, you know, my figures might not be quite accurate, but they're not far off. What they gross. This is what people are aiming for now. It's like streaming. They're not even thinking about manufacturing a funky little 7-inch or something, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a world of difference between the sort of mega successful acts and people who are trying to get started. But, you know, as you were saying, and as, you know, the figures I just mentioned suggest, like getting started 30 or 40 years ago, it wasn't great then either. You know, it's never been great trying to start a music career.
No, you've got to basically persevere. I mean, the thing is, if the hardest thing, you know, a very good thing is, who's a good songwriter? And I luckily work with the people like Jeb Loy Nichols, Bim Sherman, Lee Stephen Kenny, LSK, you know, really, you know, good songwriters around us, and Mark Stewart, you know, they're all actually, I love them as songwriters. So we've always had good songs written for the label when we did do, not when it wasn't instrumental, when it was vocal. I always tried to make good lyrics. But being a good songwriter, that's what generally leads to real mega success. You know, instrumental dubs got its niche, and I'm very proud, and I will continue doing whatever I want to do. But if you're looking on success, it's really combinations of really good songwriters, good performances, and capturing the imagination of a public, you know.
Yeah.
To get those mega streaming figures.
Yeah. So just going back to your kind of early period as a producer, was there a record where you really felt you'd nailed it? What was the first point at which you felt you were really nailing it?
Probably Mark Stewart's Learning to Cope with Cowardice album. And that album I thought was very complete and a really great piece of work.
Which year was that? Roughly.
Was it 83?
Right, yeah, okay.
If you don't know that album, have a listen to it, because it's a great album.
And
it's and it still stands up to this day. So.
Had there been a change in your approach which got you to that place of, you know, really nailing it?
Well, when I started, I didn't know what I was doing, really. I just want more reverb, more delay, more, you know. And then as you learn things, and then then sometimes you learn a lot of stuff, then you've got to go through a process of unlearning. You know, it was like with Mark, it was like literally we taped over the meters on the quarter inch tape we were mixing to. You can't be going saturating 2-inch tapes, but you so we were overdriving, we were like have tubes with microphones playing things down there. With Mark, I learnt so much about anti-production as well, working with someone like him and Mark Smith from The Fall, about not using the effects and keeping it dry. And I started picking up new tricks from some very, very creative people and applying it to the next thing. And then the next thing you learn, you know, you keep learning. If you're working with greats, and I've been so blessed to work with absolute musical giants, you know. And
how did you meet Mark Smith?
In Rough Trade Shop.
Right. Yeah.
And we got on well, and I was friends with him and Kay Carroll and used to stay up with them, and used to come and visit me and my wife at the time in Kishi in London, and we'd stay with them, and I did a few recordings with him and helped him on a few tracks, and then whatever. It was a proper, but it was interesting with him because everybody else was using reverbs, delays and studio techs. He wanted it dry, and the power of the thing was what it was all about, and the riffs and, you know, kind of anti-production kazoos and things like that. He's like, it was proper, but just that approach, I'd not really thought of it like that. And then when I started doing a mix that was really wet, covered in reverb and delays, then you suddenly pull it back to something really dry, and then do a kind of irritating distortion EQ sweep thing through the hats or something, and then make it pulse with the reverbs again. It's just ideas of how not to keep doing exactly the same. I'll just go mad with this or mad with that, and control it and hold up a healthy tension by keeping it dry, the production. That was the starting point when I started balancing. I wanted to make it sound good without one effect, and then knowing I could go back to that dry sound. And I got a lot of that from seeing Mark's insistence on not using the reverbs and delays.
Going back to Rough Trade, you mentioned in that interview that I keep referring to, that like Jeff Travis from Rough Trade initially didn't like the Creation Rebel album, but then after John Peel played it, he changed his mind. Is that true?
Yeah, it is, but bless him. I don't think, you know, he had so many other things on his plate at the time, but that's what happened, yeah. The Richard Scott there was so helpful. Jeff's my mate. I like, you know, Jeff's got his ears and what he likes, what he likes. Richard Scott really was always helping me up there. He just passed away, rest in peace. Last month, Richard died. He was a former manager of Third World, a beautiful man, a lovely man.
Yeah. Okay, I wanted to ask about industrial, actually, because you were involved in a few of the Ministry albums.
One album, just the first album.
Well, you definitely crop up in some of the other wiki entries for those subsequent albums. But I mean, I was really into Ministry when I was younger. It was a slightly later era. I was into the kind of Psalm 69 era of Ministry, but I've gone back and kind of become acquainted with the earlier stuff, and it's fucking awesome, actually. And also with First Nine Inch Nails album. So tell me about industrial generally and how it fitted in to the other stuff that you were doing, or what you'd come out.
Well, I mean, people just put a name on something. I think what happened with me, I wasn't particularly into listening to this, that, and the other. I knew Throbbing Gristle and a few, you know, 23 Skidoo and lots of other non-reggae things that were quite edgy and noisy and with, you know, good ideas going on. But we did Tackhead, and I got approached by Al to do the album, and and that album, I just met Keith LeBlanc, and we cut some tunes for Ministry that I ended up swapping with Al. I gave him a couple of things of mine that we worked on, and then the session we ran with Keith became the first Tackhead record.
Oh, right.
And then when we did Tackhead, and then combining Ministry, Tackhead, then they'd heard the Mafia, Mark Stewart and the Mafia. Then people start saying, "Oh, Adrian Sherwood, industrial." I never thought right. of that. I was industrial. And then people started saying, "Oh, would you do 9 Inch Nails?" And Trent used to come to all our gigs and stand next to me on the gigs. "Oh, please, producers. And I was a bit, you know, when he started, and then.
Hang on a second. Let me stop you there, because I wanted to ask you about doing the Ministry album in particular, because that involved going to America, and like there must have been a bit of a change of scene for you, right? And you were still really young at that point, right?
I still am.
Of course.
No, about that. I was 26 or something.
Oh, okay. Not that young then. Right. Okay. But yeah, tell me about it. Tell me about going to Chicago, right, to record it.
We went to Chicago. I got picked up by Danny, whose boyfriend owned Wax Trax Record at the airport, with Al. Then we went to his house, and then we started playing tunes, and he just had a baby, and I just had a baby. His baby was called Adrian, and mine was called Denise, and we started working on the record. And I was playing in Mark Stewart, which he hadn't heard, and it flipped him out. He loved the frequencies. I think Sire Records, Seymour, wanted me to make a kind of version of the of Al's dance music meets Depeche Mode or something. So what he got, I don't think he was very happy. He hated me, Seymour Stein. And that was the story of that album.
Were you familiar at all with American dance music that was happening? I mean, Chicago House and that kind of stuff. Were you familiar at all with that stuff?
Yeah, I was. I mean, I four on the floor dance music, although I had a couple of hit records doing it, you know, like Gary Clayton and whatever else, I couldn't sit in a room listening boof, 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 right. boof all day long. It used to send me mad, even if it was Steppers reggae. I like the stuff with the swing and the more whatever, which is not that commercial, because most folk wanted four on the floor and still do dance music on a global level, you know. I mean, with the 9 Inch Nails, I literally did a mix for Keith LeBlanc for Down On It. You know, that's all I did. I didn't do anything more than that.
Okay, was Keith LeBlanc more involved in that than you?
Well, he programmed all the drums. I kept refusing to do the job because I was so busy doing my other stuff.
Okay, because this is funny. I listened to a long interview with Trent Reznor the other day, coincidentally, and he was talking about that album. And he talks about a unspecified English producer who he reckons he didn't get on very well with. So would that have been Keith LeBlanc?
No, I can't see. I did not get on with it. I don't know. I can't see. No, Keith's American. Keith's American.
So, oh, right. So okay. Or maybe it was you then. I don't know.
Well, no, he didn't. I spoke to Trent a couple of years ago. I did a job for him.
Okay. I've been trying to figure out who this would have been, but I mean, yeah, I've just.
Well, no, Trent and me, I spoke to him and his you know, the English guy he works with the other day, very respectful. You know, I did a couple of other mixes for Trent over the years for 9 Inch Nails.
Yeah, no, that's the thing, because I know you'd work with him again subsequently, so I didn't think it was you.
But I never worked with him. I never worked with him together. I mean, what happened was his manager and my manager were the same person, Ros Earls, for a while.
Oh, right, okay.
And Ros kept saying, "Oh, Trent wants to work, we're going to do something." And then he'd gone and hired, I was going to, and then he'd hired, he was living in the house where Sharon Tate had got murdered, and I just thought, oh, this isn't for me. I don't want to go in. I'm not interested for a frigging second to go and work with Trent and Marilyn Manson or whoever.
That was on the Downward Spiral album, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, I don't remember. I can't remember. I'm not. But they said, "Oh, look, come and work." And I was going to do it. And then I said, "Look, I'm just not comfy with this. I don't like, you know, my mates, where's Adrian? Oh, he's with Trent Reznor in the house where, you know, the Manson family committed all those atrocities." I just was like, kind of, you know what, this isn't for me. This ain't for me. Sorry. And that's what, that honestly was why I didn't work on that album at that time.
Yeah,
because I was tentative.
Yeah,
I loved the sonic he was getting. I loved where the sound was really exciting. But I thought to me, no, this isn't me. No, thank you. I've got other things to do. And then I ended up doing a couple of things. I did one thing with Mark Stewart, Starfuckers Incorporated, and another thing. But and then he approached me about the Halsey mix because he was producing her.
Oh yeah, that was recently, wasn't it? Yeah,
that was a couple of years ago. So I spoke to Attica and him, Atticus and him then.
You know. Yeah.
But I you know, I would have liked, I regret not actually doing something in the room with him, you know, together. But never say never. But the you know, I can't start taking claim for anything in industrial things. Just people approached me, and because I always needed money to prop up the company, I kept doing remixes.
You're talking about the label there, right? Prop up the label.
Yeah.
And yeah, you remixed all kinds of stuff, didn't you? In fact, during that period.
No, I did the remixes. I didn't take on a remix unless I thought I could improve it, and you know, do something really good. The only one I really did, I did a really bad job on, I'm ashamed of, was the Megadeth thing. That got caught up, and I was in a really terrible state, and I didn't do a good job for them. But the others, I tried everything I did. I thought it was, you know, what it was. A lot of time, it wasn't even the band. It was a record company would say, "Oh, we want you to do a mix," you know, of this, and they were thinking, "Oh, get six remixes done. Get Adrian Sherwood to do the weirdest one. We put them all out, and they all contributed to the chart position of the act."
Right.
That's how it worked in those days. So you'd see 10 mixes, and it was just mad marketing things and so much money swilling around because the CD had been invented, and all these companies were making literally billions by marketing their back catalogues on CD and investing the money in all sorts of foolishness. That's what was going on.
Yeah, actually quite similar to what's happened in the music industry in the last sort of 7 or 8 years, actually, because they had this massive injection of streaming money, which no one saw come in, and suddenly the labels are rich again, right? So just doing crazy shit.
Yeah, that's the one.
What was your, well, how did you approach doing remixes in those days? Like, how different was it from your general approach in the studio, if at all different?
Well, no, I just looked on it as a version, and then I looked on it as a dub version meets a kind of the sensibilities of the artist that I was working for. And I just thought, I've got to make it sound quite a lot different to the original. Otherwise, what's the point? Hmm. And that's how I did it.
In practical terms, in those days, did you just get the tapes, like the stems on tape? Like, how did it actually work?
Yeah, they'd send over a multi-track. Or I'd ask for a multi-track copy. I would then deconstruct it, overdub it, maybe add something to it, and then I would rip it to pieces and then edit the best bits together to make a remix.
So, I mean, what was your kind of priority, I guess, is the question I'm wondering, in this kind of a period? Like, we talked about, you know, wanting to make records and, you know, having to pay the bills, and that kind of develops over the course of, I guess, of the 80s. And, you know, you talked about getting to a point where you're really confident in what you're doing and thinking you're making really good stuff. But, like, what was your major priority by the end of that kind of 1980s period?
Well, I was working with Tackhead, and Tackhead was smashing it. It was brilliant. Where the Sugar Hill Gang rhythm section, they were, like, amazing. And Mark Stewart was on mute. I kept thinking, you know, if we put the productions on bigger labels. I looked at On You Sound as a production house. I didn't see it like as being, you know, I want to make the label massive. I wanted to keep producing things I wanted to do and see them on a big label and see them become successful. So I kept thinking everything I was doing was going to sell 10 times more than it did.
Right, okay.
That's the problem. But we never promoted, but we kept our dignity. No, that's what my aim. I mean, it was literally, I kept thinking, then we had a fluke hit with Human Nature. It wasn't because of me, it was because Bobby Marshall, who's my dear friend, he manages Asian Dub Foundation. He's worked with me forever, but Bob got Oakenfold and Steve Osborne to remix it, and we had a fluke hit, which, you know, that didn't do as much good, to be honest. In pulling a sideways kind of thing, but you know, and then one thing after another, I ended up going for a divorce in 90, you know, breakup in 94, and then after that I was in chaos, to be honest. So the period, you know, that 14 years from 80 to 94, it all kind of just took a different path, really, after that.
Sorry, with Tackhead, were you touring a lot with that band as well?
Yes, yeah.
Tell me about that. Like, what were you...
Tackhead was Doug, Skip, Keith and me. And then we added Bernard Fowler. And then we were also had Mark Stewart. So it was Tackhead, stroke Mark Stewart and the Maffin. It was like a really intense, great show, you know. And then when it all kind of came to the end in 1990, Bernard joined the Rolling Stones, which he's been with ever since. And he became...
Right, of course. I was wondering where I knew that name from. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And then Dougie went off to do Living Colour. Keith did this, that and the other session, you know, massive sessions. And Skip and me teamed up doing loads of productions and working together. So... Right. You know, Yielding Little Acts and all sorts of really nice productions. You know, Miracle album with Bim Sherman and all sorts of other things.
Where are the main, like, where had you toured mostly? Were you doing the States? Was it mostly Europe?
No, we did, well, England, if we did England, you know, we'd sell London out in about an hour. I always tend to play the Forum and then yeah. We'd go to Japan, America, Australia, New Zealand, went all over the planet, really.
And was that like full-on tour buses?
Yeah,
kind of
well, in those days you toured, but it wasn't like long tours, a week or two. I wasn't into these 2-3 month tours. I had a family at home and I, you know.
I mean, it's a difficult lifestyle, right?
It's not one for me, really. I love doing the gigs. I still do love doing them to this day, but you've got to be a real hardcore warrior musician to do what musicians do. It's a very, very demanding life. And
yeah, no, it absolutely is. Yeah. And it's I don't know, I guess it's kind of a shame really that it's become that much more necessary now, I think, for people today, because as you said previously, like prior, this was a record business at its core, and it now feels like it's a touring business at its core. Is that fair, do you think?
Well, it was always touring. You always had to tour, but in the old days you toured. Record companies would sponsor the tour as part of the promotion budget to sell the record, but the end product was selling huge amounts of something that yielded money per unit. Now it's the other way around. You're looking for making a record and letting everyone hear it to get your notice so you can go and make money touring. But it's still the same in many ways, where, you know, the big acts scoop up most of the money and the little acts are scraping around the bottom trying to get a gig in the few pubs that still put bands on.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened then in that period after 94? I mean, you've just kind of like delineated that as a kind of cutoff point, but what happened after that for you?
Well, I've gone through periods. You go through periods where you're not, and I wasn't good in myself. I must be honest. I wasn't looking after myself. And although we made some great records, you know, I did Echo Deck with Primal Scream and did Miracle with Bim Sherman, Wolf that House Built with Little Axe and some other nice records. But I went through quite a period where you then go through a period where people really, your stock goes down. There's new exciting things, you know, Jungle was born. There was like loads of new movements in things. And to a degree, I got left behind, but I wasn't, just was not on it at all. And, you know, I think I made some great records then, but nothing like what before. And it took me quite a long time to kind of regroup myself, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that's normal, you know. I think there are kind of cycles in music, and, you know, I think a big challenge of anyone who's making music and kind of out there is to stay quote-unquote relevant, which is a kind of depressing way of putting it. But, I mean, yeah, the cycle, the wheel does turn, right? And I think basically everyone who's had a long career has a moment where they're like, fuck, this isn't quite what it was. And then, you know, and it's a case of like coming back from that, right?
Yeah, you have to rise again if you want to. But it's you know, with me, because I'm not actually a musician, right? It's, you know, working with good people, and then, you know, the ambience around is very difficult to put it into words, where if everybody seems inspired and positive, and it's like, you know, at the moment the air around the country is one of like, oh god, oh, like this, you know, there's not one of huge optimism and huge belief that you can change the world and great things can happen. We're getting battered by, the god-awful situation in Palestine and the, and Yemen and world affairs and everything like that. And look around our own country, the homelessness, this awful Nazi government, this horrific, horrific people, in that government. So it's just the ambience hasn't led to feeling, oh great, we're going to go out Friday night, let's change the world and whatever. It's probably because of my age now, but I'm sure the youngsters don't feel anything like I am, because they probably don't even pay attention to the nastiness. But those periods, I felt in a certain period, in the late 90s, I wasn't really at all on it, I've got to be honest. And I had to regroup, build my whole self and everything bit by bit as I went into the 21st century.
Yeah, I wanted to talk basically about like dance music generally and electronic stuff, but also then going into dubstep, because obviously you've worked with Pinch and I know you were kind of interested in that stuff. So, I mean, just to go back, I mean, to ask you briefly about Chicago House, and you've mentioned jungle there. Like, what's been your opinion and your kind of relationship with dance music over time, since Acid House first happened? And, what's been your kind of relationship personally with it?
Well, a lot of it I was observing, because I can't claim that I, when I worked with the hip-hop crew, I was working with the original, as I was with the Jamaican dancehall and the roots reggae people. We had the original players, When we went into the kind of housey, dancey scene, we had David Harrow and people, and I'd worked with Steve Beresford in the first things ever getting me involved with dance music. We weren't exactly, it wasn't our thing, we want to make, club music. I never thought of it. I was more interested in the sonic sound, African head charge type things than I was in Chicago House or something. But then every time I ventured into making club-friendly stuff using our sonic, it did very well. When I heard Jungle for the first time, I thought, what is that? I didn't even know if I liked it. And then when I heard it in a club, it was like, oh, right, I get it. Because I could obviously hear it was like double-speed reggae. That's what it sounded like to me. And then I became good friends with Congo Natty, and I started really getting into the excitement of it. And I think that's the thing with anything, real excitement in... Some people are genuinely, genuinely excited by, house music, relentless, non-stop house music. I would hear one or two tunes and think, wow, that's an amazing tune. But my relationship with it wasn't one I'm going to venture into. I am going to work today to make a club tune. I never planned that. But probably very much because I didn't have the characters around that wanted to do that and said, come on, Adrian, come on, let's do this, let's do that. If I applied myself, if I'd worked with, some of the great house producers in Chicago, so I'm sure I'd have come up with something really good. I made a good contribution to the work.
Did you get involved in Acid House as a raver at all?
I used to go down to Dungeons on Lee Bridge Road. And I remember the first time very early doors taking ecstasy for the first time. And it was just like, oh my God, this is unbelievable.
Yeah, that's always a memorable event, right?
It was unbelievable, yeah. And it changed society. I mean, that whole movement was very, very important. I used to go to West Ham, all the home games. I live right next to the stadium, and there was lots of Aggie racism, violence, and, from lots of teams. And then that was East London, and then when we used to go to Dungeons, it was full of, football fans who'd previously, a West Ham lot, all cuddling each other and smiling and happy. And it literally... I think it played a major part in redefining all that, really did.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a guy called Gerald on the show actually a few months ago, and we talked about that whole stuff, and he really confirmed what, it's kind of a legend and almost a cliche at this point, but I mean, according to him, and obviously according to you too, it's absolutely accurate the effect that it had on society.
I witnessed it firsthand. You go to the club and the bouncers were gentler. The whole ambience in there was no you know, the only problem was when people were trying to police the drug dealing, you know, and people getting aggy and some things like that went on. But the crowd itself and the change of ambience in the whole of the society amongst the age group that were going to those clubs and the former people who, you know, they should have just given that to everybody going to the ground who had an attitude Seeing people cuddly, literally, honestly, it was amazing. I was just grinning ear to ear. And, you know, the best club we went to anyway was called Dungeons on the Lee Bridge Road. It was like amazing. So,
do you remember which DJs you saw there?
Well, I saw all the DJs over the years at various other events, but I can't remember the Acid House DJs at Dungeons. I could find out for you. I just make one phone call, and Leah would remember everybody.
So, yeah, dubstep. I was going to be the last thing I wanted to ask you about. Well, as mentioned, like, I know you work with Pinch and stuff, but like, what was your feeling about it when you first kind of heard it or heard about it? What did you think when you heard about this dubstep stuff?
Well, I started hearing things like Horsepower and other people who'd done things, and I first heard it in a rehearsal room on a PA, and I kind of thought I was like. You can know when something's good when you feel, and even the word jealousy, it's not jealous, but you think, God, I wish I'd been involved in that. That is amazing. It isn't me being jealous of their thing.
It's being inspired, I think, because it's the kind of thing, like, you hear something, it's like, oh, I've got to get in the studio and make something now.
Well,
you know?
I didn't know anybody who was doing it at the time, but blown away was the word. I was like, wow, this is like fantastic. You know, and all those tunes like Where's My Money and all that. It was just like, kind of, Jesus, that is fantastic. And I met Pinch, and what we did together, I was very proud of, and I think it's still wonderful records, but I think we fell a little bit between, it wasn't enough dubstep or enough my kind of area to satisfy everybody. Mm. But there's a number of people who actually totally love those two albums so much. It's ridiculous, but hey, I mean those movements all coming from originally the dancehalls of Kingston, Jamaica in the 60s, and the Lee Perry, Keith Hudson, King Tubby influenced productions, and you know, the Jamaican saying each one teach one's proven there, because that's its development.
Yeah, I mean, that's a completely and a very direct result of what we were talking about right at the start, almost. It's just the influence of people coming into the UK and influencing the UK music scene, right? You know, people come from different
absolutely,
parts of the world.
Absolutely, totally. Absolutely, totally.
Yeah. So, okay, very last question. Is Damon Albarn a nice bloke?
Very, very good question. Hang on a second. Let me take this call. One sec. I would say Damon Albarn is the most competitive person I've ever come across, and he's very talented. Down to being nice, I'm sure his mum loves him. I liked him as well. He was actually very kind to me, and I like him.
Nice one. Well, listen, Adrian, thanks for your time today, mate. It's been great. Really enjoyed it.
Cheers, Paul. Much speak later. Bye.
Yeah, as I mentioned at the top, that was a slightly truncated conversation. He had to run off and take a call. Normally, I like going longer than that, as you will be aware. But we got some good stuff out of him. Nonetheless, I could easily have gone through everything in much more detail. I knew there was a limited time period, which is kind of explains my line of questioning and the fact that I was willing to move on from things probably more readily than I would normally be. But yeah, what a legendary career. I mean, I didn't even know he worked with Nine Inch Nails until quite recently. I mean, yeah, he didn't like being asked those questions that much, I got the impression, but maybe I was being a little bit obtuse. I have to say, if you're going to listen to a podcast, listen to Trent Reznor's appearance on Rick Rubin's podcast. That is a really interesting talk. Highly recommended. Okay, that's about it for this week. Shorter than usual. Reminder about the pledge drive. Remember, if you're British, you should stop being so tight and support the podcasts that you listen to. I'm just joking, of course, but it would be nice of you to do so. It genuinely would. If you're not going to do that, as mentioned, no problem. Leave us a review or a rating and follow the show. That's the most important thing. Hit follow wherever you're listening to this podcast. Also follow the Spotify playlist and come into the Discord, hotflushrecordings.com/discord. Join us there to discuss what's going on. And I will see you back here same time, same place next week for the next episode of the Not a Diving Podcast. Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.